At this time, let me invite you to turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 1. Ecclesiastes chapter 1. This is found on page 670 in your Pew Bible. Ecclesiastes chapter 1. Let me take a moment to outline for you what's going on in Ecclesiastes chapter 1 and chapter 2. We've already gone through verses 1 through 11. That's an introduction. It has its own argument. The preacher comes back and wants to look at it from another viewpoint. So we have here in Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verses 1 through 11, an argumentation that really seeks to demonstrate that life, this life, the life that we live here and now, is fleeting, fading, and frustrating. And he says, I want to demonstrate that to you by asking this question: What advantage, what lasting gain does man have in all of his, and then the word here is work, sometimes translated toil, which he does under the sun? He's not just merely, though, talking about work. He's talking about all of the ways in which we involve ourselves in this life. You'll see that in a moment. He then looks at the sun. He looks at the wind. He looks at the water channels. He looks at even our own existence, and he demonstrates that really there is no lasting gain in this life. We will not be able to carry with us anything into heaven. There will be nothing to show before the Lord. There will be nothing for us to, in one sense, there will be no palace, no mansion, no 401, there's no retirement, nothing to bring into heaven, no toys in this life. That's not to say that life is meaningless. That's not to say that everything is futile. But it is to say that we have to have a right perspective. He then goes, and you can see here in verse 12, he introduces himself again. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel. Why is he introducing himself again? Well, because he wants us to understand that what he's about to say here is, not only have I demonstrated this from nature, but let me tell you about my experience. Let me tell you about this investigation that I went on, that I pursued, so that I could really come to answer the question, what advantage does man have in all his work which he does under the sun? And there's some things to be said there. We're going to look at that in a moment. But really, that's what really 12 to 18 is. I went under investigation myself. And then in chapter 2, he says, and these are the things I investigated. Now, you should know some commentaries, one in particular I thought was really helpful, but also it provided 9 different categories in verses 1 through 11. 9 different areas that the preacher, that Solomon pursued, that he by wisdom, he went into investigation to see, can I find lasting gain in any of these things? I'm going to break those down to 3. But the answer is no. And so then he backs up in verse 12 there, and he says, I mean, let's just think about this for a moment. Even the fact that I've pursued all of this in wisdom, is there anything that wisdom itself gives in terms of gain? I mean, at least I have this right perspective. No. No. Because whether you're a wise or you're a fool, you all end up in the same place, that is, in the grave. And so you can see he's moving us, again, to come to terms with death. In verses 18 to 23, he says, but maybe there's something to be said about all of these labors. By the way, now you know that the word work, or the word toil, the word labor, is not just connected to like what we do every day in terms of like go to work. It really does deal with all these nine different areas. Whether I'm pursuing pleasure, whether I'm pursuing possessions, whether I'm pursuing promotion, all of those different things. And so, in verses 18 to 23, he even considers that maybe the answer is just the fact that I'm working itself. That must be the lasting gain. But no. It all is elusive. You can't hold on to it. You lose your grip. It goes through your fingers. Death is inevitable. And then in verse 24 through 26, which has often been misunderstood, he says, "There's nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor's good." And this is where people think, oh, see, he's just promoting kind of a hedonistic view. You know, hey, eat, drink, and be merry. Tomorrow we'll die. That's not what he's saying. I intended to try and get through all of chapter 2 today. And if you know me, you know already how much of a challenge that is. But I really want you to see this is the argumentation. And there's something really important in terms of his first conclusion there in chapter 2, verse 24. We're going to go there next week, Lord willing. Today, we're limited to verses 1 through 11. And the sermon of the title is kind of the theme of the sermon. Looking for life in all the wrong places. Looking for lasting gain in all of the wrong places. So now with that outline before you, and I'll have to carefully navigate through my notes so I'm not super redundant. Let's read chapter 1, verses 12 through 18 to see what it is that that the preacher is going to endeavor on this investigation. He's going to enter into this investigation and see what he says. I have some comments to make on these verses in the introduction. All right. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, beginning at verse 12, this is the word of God. "I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I set my mind to seek and explore by wisdom concerning all that has been done under heaven. It is a grievous task which God has given to the sons of men to be afflicted with. I've seen all the works which have been done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and striving after wind. What is crooked cannot be straightened, and what is lacking cannot be counted. I said to myself, behold, I've magnified and increased wisdom more than all who were over Jerusalem before me, and my mind has observed a wealth of wisdom and knowledge. And I set my mind to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I realize that this also is striving after wind. Because in much wisdom there is much grief, and increasing knowledge results in increasing pain." So far from God's holy word. Well, as we have already said, this introduction in verses 1 through 11 has the preacher showing us how nature itself demonstrates there is no lasting gain that can be found in all of our human toiling in this life. Now the preacher wants to continue the argument from the bitter experiences and examples of everyday life, things that you and I can all relate to. Consider, first of all, that Solomon records for us, like a journal entry, his setting out on an investigation. You see that there in verse 12. "I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I've set my mind to seek and explore by wisdom concerning all that has been done under heaven." Solomon, in some ways, is a very unique person in history. Not only did he have this wisdom from God in an abundant sense, he was then equipped to be able to really look at and assess if there really was any lasting benefit to this life. But he also had, as a king, almost unlimited resources. He could use his whole kingdom at his own disposal to put many, many works to the test. Listen to this record in 1 Kings chapter 4. Now God gave Solomon wisdom and very great discernment and breadth of mind like the sand that is on the seashore. Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the sons of the east and all the wisdom of Egypt. For he was wiser than all men, than Ethan the Ezrahite, Haman, Calcol, and Darda, the sons of Mahol, and his fame was known in all the surrounding nations. He also spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. He spoke of trees, from the cedar that is in Lebanon, even to the hyssop that grows on the wall. He spoke also of animals and birds and creeping things and fish. Men came from all peoples to hear the wisdom of Solomon, from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom. Well, we don't know who Ethan the Ezrahite is, but we know who Solomon is. And what is it that Solomon found? Well, we see that in verses 14 and again in 17 that really all is vanity and chasing after the wind. The word there for striving or chasing sounds a lot like the word for shepherding. The word doesn't mean shepherding. This word means chasing or striving. But when you hear it, if you were hearing it with a Hebrew ear, you would think comically, how funny would it be to try and shepherd the wind? You can't do it. So that is the conclusion. All is vanity. That's nothing new to us. But they are summarized, this conclusion is summarized in these two big thoughts. In verses 12 to 15, he says that to look for all the potential fullness that this life has to offer is, verse 13, a grievous and afflicting task that God has laid on man. In other words, the miserable business that we experience in this life, the vanity we experience in this life, has been ordained by God. Not that He's the author of it, so much as He is in control and sovereign over it. Solomon is giving God His right place as the one who is in charge. He says that we're in constant pursuit then of fixing life. But you can see here in this proverb he gives in verse 15, what is crooked cannot be straightened, what is lacking cannot be counted. We shall learn that instead of correcting the crooked or counting the lacking things, we ought to be accepting what comes from God's hand. He'll soon provide details, but we are to understand that instead of finding gain, there is actually grief in this kind of endeavor. In fact, this is how the preacher came to his viewpoint shared in the introduction. The second summary for us that brings us to the conclusion, or that brings the preacher to the conclusion, all is vanity, is found in verses 16 to 18. That to truly know wisdom, you must also understand its opposite, madness and folly. Now that's a very fascinating thought in and of itself. And it's one thing to have a proverbial knowledge, well, the wise does this and the fool does that. It's a whole other thing when you play the part of the fool in order to learn foolishness. Did Solomon imagine that in pursuit of both wisdom and folly, he would distinguish and be able to avoid the trials and traps of life? I don't know. I'm not sure. But Solomon was investigating with eyes opened. And he sought, it says here, both extremes. He was committed to searching the borders of this life, the perimeters that God had established. But He's also committed, I hope you see it, that He would in folly transgress those borders. And this is where we find Solomon to be wrong. And we can look at other portions of Scripture and see how that foolishness played out and how it affected the kingdom even after he died. Solomon can say that he experienced all that this life has to offer, but at what cost? There is a way in which he is teaching us wisdom by helping us to see his own foolishness. He's telling us in a warning way at times, this is folly. Do not do it. We need to heed this word. You can see that he says here in verse 18, there was no lasting gain here, only wind chasing. And in fact, much wisdom brings grief and pain. While Solomon shares his bitter experiences and examples of everyday life and seeking to persuade us that lasting gain cannot be found in the various issues and toils and works of life. Still, by way of introduction, to be clear, Solomon is not saying anything different than what he's already said in chapter 1, verses 1 through 11. But he's rather reaffirming through experience, the same truth. Though we seek to distract ourselves from our looming mortality, it is not this life, nor anything in this life, that will keep us from our inevitable end in this life. This text today is for the person who tries to find permanence in this life. Certainly, this text is for the skeptic. Certainly, this text is for the one who puts all of their confidence and hope in this material world. One commentator, Ian Proven, says this: "This section of Ecclesiastes is a sobering account of the relentless anxiety of the materialist who lives under the shadow of unavoidable death." But Christian, understand, this text is also for you. Because it is very easy for us in this world, in this life, to lose sight of the world to come. To have what Paul Tripp calls eternity amnesia. Another commentator, David Gibson, says this: "We become fully integrated in this world rather than viewing ourselves as passing through. And we do this by living as if our greatest treasures are here and now. We display our sense of permanence by our lifestyle choices." Oh, what does that look like? Well, consider the homes that we live in, the money we spend, the churches we build, the investments we pursue, the priorities that we live for. We hold the good things of this world too tightly and lavish our affections on them too freely. We strive and strain for the same kind of gain as everyone else around us. That's our experience. And so this is the Word of God for us today. There are many things that we bring into our lives to distract us and divert us from the miseries and mistakes and misunderstandings of this life. And Solomon wants to investigate all of them. And so with that, we're going to spend the rest of our time today looking at chapter 2, verses 1 through 11. 2 points. The first one is, we want to look at the various tests. And the second one is, we want to consider the same result. The various tests and the same result. And I will read Ecclesiastes 2 as we move point by point. That way we can keep along with the text. So first, let us consider the various tests. Look at chapter 2, verse 1. I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure, so enjoy yourself. And so what is the first test? Well, it is pleasure. Pleasure. Understanding pleasure. What is the most evoked emotion used in advertisements and commercials? What's the most evoked emotion? Some think that it's fear, to drive people in fear to purchase or get what you don't have. But actually, the most evoked emotion is happiness. And the message is very simple, even though it comes to us in many, many different forms. This will make you happy. This will make you happy. And which already implies something that you and I want very much to be happy. And so we go for these things. In 2009, Coke put a special vending machine in college campuses. And you would go and the student would buy a bottle of Coke and then 10 would come out. And they would, you know, just start to be very happy over this and joyous. Well, then things started getting weird because they would put money in, they'd get a Coke, and then someone would, an arm would come out with flowers. And they would be giving flowers to people. And then they'd put money in and out would come a hand making a balloon animal. And once they sent a pizza through, and then even one of the most delightful things at the end, this 6-foot sub, then multiple students had to come and carry it out. And everyone's just smiling and enjoying this. And what a great machine. And here's the message. Amid the difficulties and pressures and complications that you're experiencing, and what college student wouldn't know those things, have a Coke. It'll make you happy. Solomon considers the pursuit of pleasure as well. Solomon thinks to himself, hey, come on now, lighten up. Investigate joy. Investigate gladness of heart. This was not a new message. Solomon's not the first one to pursue pleasure. We can see it in many pages prior to the book of Ecclesiastes in the Bible. But also, the hedonist school of philosophy taught this approach to me as the meaning of life. That actually, pleasure is at the center of the meaning of life. Happiness is the most important focus of life. And the most well-known and moderate form of this view was that from the Epicureans. And so Paul encountered this when he addressed the Athenians in Mars Hill. You can look at Acts chapter 17 to see this. Verse 18 if you want a reference. But Epicurus, this philosopher, taught that through the avoidance of pain and the pursuit of pleasure, people could attain true and lasting happiness. Now tell me, doesn't that sound familiar? Isn't that like one of the main messages of our own culture today? What was the result of this? You can see there at the end of verse 1, behold, it too was futility, or it too was vanity. I said of laughter, it's madness. And of pleasure, what does it accomplish? Now you might think, I know what's going on here. The preacher is a Puritan. That's his problem. Right? He's just an old fuddy-duddy. He doesn't understand how to have a good time. Well, understand that what Solomon is not saying here is that laughter is meaningless or that laughter is bad in and of itself. In fact, we're going to see soon, as we continue to read through the book, that there is a right place for joy and laughter. One of God's great designs is to bring joy into our life. But laughter is something that is fleeting and fading. What you laughed at this morning is forgotten by this evening. Not only this, but humor can often be used to cover up fear or despair. This is not foreign to what's considered conventional wisdom in the book of Proverbs. Proverbs 14:13, even in laughter the heart may be in pain, and the end of joy may be grief. Further, laughter can also be done at the expense of one who's being scorned or mocked without that person even knowing. They're not in on the joke. Or laughter can be used to express cynicism, sarcasm, or doubt. And so this pursuit of pleasure through comedy or laughter, it is something without lasting gain. And when sober amusement does not distract the soul, Solomon, you notice, pursues a merry heart from alcohol. Look at verse 3. I explored with my mind how to stimulate my body with wine, while my mind was guiding me wisely, and how to take hold of folly until I could see what good there is for the sons of men to do under heaven the few years of their lives. By the way, this is the second time the language of under heaven has shown up. Don't think there's any difference between under the sun and under heaven. Under heaven is like the idea of under the sky. It's the same thing, under the sun, okay, under heaven. But notice what's being said here by Solomon. He seeks to both guide his mind with wisdom while taking hold of folly. This is a self-contradiction. How can you both be wise and foolish at the same time? He is actually under the impression that he can participate in folly while being very conscious in a wise way about what he's doing, as if being aware of it doesn't make it foolishness. We can sometimes deceive ourselves in this way too. Well, I want you to understand that this verse is not a condemnation of alcohol in and of itself. We will see that the Lord has given us alcohol to be used in moderation. But how many have taken hold of foolishness by taking hold of and misusing alcohol? The Bible is clear that abusing alcohol and getting drunk are sinful. But Solomon is highlighting something else here in this particular verse. He's using alcohol to see if its effects will provide some kind of relief from the torment that he experiences as he reflects on the fleeting, fading, and frustrating nature of this life. He's already discovered vanity in some sense. Will alcohol somehow be a means of help with this? Really, what he's proposing is using alcohol to self-medicate. Using alcohol as a tool for coping with his despair. The Apostle Paul has the answer to facing daily challenges. In Ephesians 5:18, he tells us, "Do not get drunk with wine, for that is immoral, but be filled with the Spirit." And I'll let you go on and read what Paul says in Ephesians 5 and 6 to understand what it means to be filled with the Spirit. But for Solomon, he has not found lasting gain here. And so he moves on, and so will we. Look at verse 4. I enlarged my works. I built houses for myself. I planted vineyards for myself. I made gardens and parks for myself. And I planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made ponds of water for myself from which to irrigate a forest of growing trees. And now we move from pleasure, not to say that this isn't pleasure, but he's going to seek the the possible lasting gain of life by adding possessions to himself. And that's our second P, understanding possessions. Investigating possessions. So we've investigated pleasure, and now we're investigating possessions. Solomon became very productive, having houses, vineyards, gardens, parks, and ponds made. But I want you to know that by this production, he sought to consume much from these things. He was not merely a producer. He was also going to be and intended to be a consumer. Later on, he'll say, "These are the rewards for all of my works." But even here in this, in these verses, verses 4 through 6, you can see three times he says that he had these things built for myself. A very self-centered approach to making these things. Now, Solomon's main palace, if you read the record, took 6 more years to build than the temple. The temple, I mean, what an amazing production this really is, his palace. The word here for garden is actually a particular word for walled gardens, telling us that these are the things that not something you walk out in your backyard and you have a garden. This is enjoyed by the rich and the privileged. Perhaps Solomon is here seeking to create his own paradise. Doesn't it sound like it has echoes of Eden in it? But this is not so different. You and I don't have the resources of Solomon, but this is not so different from the man caves that we try to make, or the continual home and garden projects that we try to carry on, as if we're going to get a lasting satisfaction or gain in those things. He goes on in verse 7, "I bought male and female slaves, and I had home-born slaves. Also, I possessed flocks and herds larger than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. Also, I collected for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I provided for myself male and female singers and the pleasures of men, many concubines." Now, we have to be careful. We're still looking at possessions here. And we may read our American context into the slavery that he's speaking of here. Solomon's not a plantation owner in the historical American sense. But in his day, the main kind of slavery was indentured servitude, meaning that slaves were not owned by their masters, but they voluntarily, under some personal hardship, entered into service. But if you were a slave, then this meant that you were working in the palace, and you were living in the palace, and you were educated by the palace, and you were on the palace payroll. It was actually quite a industrious thing for a slave to try and get a job and get into the servitude of the palace. After all, these houses and vineyards and gardens and parks and ponds are not going to make themselves. You notice the language here, even homeborn slaves, which meant that your economic condition was already improved from society. And yet, just to bring this then to point, I just wanted to say that because we can wrongly read this, but to bring it to point, Solomon's paradise does not conclude with gardens. Solomon is seeking to populate his paradise with servants, to build this enterprise, herds and flocks. He's got everything there in the Eden commission. Be fruitful, multiply, replenish the earth, have dominion over the animals. This is what he's doing. He's creating a little slice of Eden for himself and sharing it with others. In these verses, there's two more for myself, so that brings our count up to five. But there's still a power over people desire here for Solomon. There's still, it's not just a slice of Eden, it's a slice of Eden that I can reign over. And this is similar to today's business owners who take their workers for granted and want more from them while offering little to no incentive. But at the same time, it's also a reminder of the employees who envy their bosses and want more from them while doing less work. All of this is fleeting and fading and frustrating. And so possessions is not where we're going to find the answer. Now he goes on and explains as well in these verses. I haven't covered it yet, but he pursues industry and music. He hires singers to accompany the beauty of his palace. One commentator says, Solomon put in a living sound system and piped the music throughout his landscape. As people walked to enjoy the gallery, they could enjoy the beauty of human voice, the stirring of melody, the foot taps of rhythm. But not only did Solomon collect servants, he collected women. A harem. Indulging in the fantasy of free love, while in reality he would have to provide for these concubines. A concubine was a woman who was provided for and protected by a man, but did not have the status of wife. And so, in the same way, not only just like with the gardens and the servants, not only is Solomon experiencing vanity, so are the servants here, not only Solomon, but these women. These women would live in the palace and they would feel as if they were desired by a king, and yet they would never have queen status. Today, men and women have instant access to hidden harems in their homes through pornography and all of the things related to this. There is a sex trade that is involved even in this city that we know very little about. Even, and as we've said, there are good things here. Laughter is good. Alcohol is good in itself. Work is good in itself. Gardens and palaces are good in themselves. Even in marital covenant goodness of sexual intimacy designed by God, life will pull you away from your bed. And so we cannot put our hope or our confidence in any way in the things of this life. We come to one more P, and that is the investigation of promotion. The investigation of promotion in verse 9. Then I became great and increased more than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. My wisdom also stood by me. All that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart was pleased because of all my labor, and this was my reward for all my labor. Listen to what he says. The eye's desire was not refused. The heart's pleasure was not withheld. And yet we know what chapter 1 has said about all that in verse 8. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. And so whatever we have, the heart wants more. That's part of the vanity of our own heart. Did promotion bring the lasting gain that he was looking for? No. Zach Eswine draws 9 basic amusements from these verses offered to every generation under the sun, not unique to Solomon. Though we don't have all the resources he has, consider this list: jokes, alcohol, art, nature, money, possessions, music, sex, affirmation, work. This is a comprehensive list of that language of all that man does with his work in chapter 1, verse 3. This is the toil that Solomon is speaking of. Is there any lasting gain in any of these kinds of things? None of them are sinful in themselves, and yet Solomon approached the border of these enjoyments and sought to draw everything he could from them to find out if there was lasting gain in this life. I want you to note what he says there in verse 10, that in a moment his heart was pleased in all these labors. There was a time period where he could sit back and enjoy what he had done. A reward for his industry and productivity. He had demonstrated that he was worthy of the title king. Here stands a king of kings. That which fills the imagination and daydreams of every human being, Solomon actually realized in his real life. Fame, fortune, fun, and yet you notice what he did not achieve? Fulfillment. Fulfillment. And it would appear that in the end, these pleasures and possessions and promotions do not last. All is vanity. That brings us to our final point then. The same result. The same result. All is vanity. Look at verse 11. I considered all my activities which my hands had done and the labor which I had exerted, and behold, all was vanity and striving after wind, and there was no profit under the sun. As Solomon is standing back and evaluating his empire and considering everything a reward, he all of a sudden comes into a sober perspective, and he returns to our theme: fleeting, fading, frustrating. This life is chasing after wind. This life produces no lasting profit. The delights and desires of this life were held by Solomon. They were actually held, but they slipped through his fingers. They escaped his grasp, his grip. Now you think about us today. As Americans, we are among the most wealthy and privileged people in the entire world. And having our material needs met, even though some would argue about that, we can look at the American soul and find that we are without contentment, without joy, without peace. We are a depressed and despairing people. And this is just a demonstration that wealth and privilege does not actually provide for us lasting gain. Our pleasures, our possessions, our promotions have become our gods and our saviors, and they only add to our miseries when we use them in that way. And these amusements quickly become shallow and superficial because they can't distract or divert us from the transiency of this life. They do not help us maintain a permanence. You look at chapter 2, verses 1 to 11, and you find that Solomon's pursuit of joy in all of these things, of purpose and fulfillment in all these things, is fleeting. And he's saying here that our endeavors cannot bring permanent satisfaction because they don't contain joy in and of themselves. Just think about it. When you were young, you dreamt about your future family, what your spouse might be like, what your kids might be like. You dreamt about your friends, your career, your car or your house, maybe some hobbies you wanted to have, some vacation spots you wanted to go to, and a host of other things. And when you become older, your dreams change. Now you're dreaming of downsizing. Now you sell all the things that you once dreamed about. And someone else is living your dream life right now as you've given it all to them. This is what the preacher will say to us later on. As he had come naked from his mother's womb, so will he return as he came. He will take nothing from the fruit of his labor that he can carry in his hand. That's where we're brought to. Whatever we've dreamt about early on, we'll have to get rid of, or we'll never even see it to begin with. And the true preacher of wisdom, the Lord Jesus Christ, he addresses this as well in one of his sermons. And we heard it today. Don't store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy, where thieves break in and steal. Store up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in or steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will follow. And the amusements of this life last for a moment, and then they turn to rust or moth food. We must turn our hearts to another kind of treasure, that which is permanent, that which is eternal. And it's okay to enjoy the treasures of this life, but the idea of storing them ignores the reality that these are just as fleeting and fading and frustrating as our life is itself. The preacher, speaking in the same spirit of Christ, is driving home through his investigation that this life is not what will bring us lasting joy. Instead, chasing after fullness from this life only brings emptiness. And so, despite our life pursuits, we're being brought towards our death. And coming to terms with where lasting gain is not, we come to terms with our death. But here's the thing where we're going. I don't want to leave you here with this necessarily. I kind of do. I want you to just kind of feel that for a minute. But I will leave you with this. Our future death is a light that God shines on our present to give us perspective. Here's how one commentator puts it. Death can radically enable us to enjoy life by relativizing all that we do in our days under the sun. Death can change us from people who want to control life for gain and to people who find deep joy in receiving life as a gift. Friends, right there, that's really the message of this whole book. We're going to come to it again and again, and in different ways. We're going to look at the same message through different facets of the same diamond that this book is to us. That life in God's world is gift, not gain. It is gift, not gain. If you have that perspective, you won't put your hope in it, but you will look to the giver. So in conclusion, we've seen the fruitless results in pursuing lasting gain in this life. Pleasure, possession, promotion, these all come with their joyful moments, but these too are fleeting and fading and frustrating. And therefore, we need to guard against seeing these as ends in and of themselves in this life. I don't know what things of this life you're clinging to today. But I do know that you are bent toward this tendency, just like I am. Like all of us who live under the sun. So let us close with these words to help bring us to sobriety and perspective. Verse 11, I considered all my activities which my hands had done and the labor which I had exerted, and behold, all was vanity and chasing after wind, and there was no profit under the sun. That is, no profit in this life. Amen.